Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pace. Criminal justice reform has had an increasing presence in the national spotlight over the last several years. It has even managed to garner rare bipartisan support in Congress. At issue are the staggering numbers of individuals in crowded prisons and jails, and the disproportionate number of the poor and people of color serving lengthy sentences due to mandatory sentencing laws. Concerns about the inequity of our justice system have led to many reforms. Here in California, legislators and voters responded by reversing the felony murder rule and reducing the reliance on cash bail, among other things. Earlier this year, Governor Gavin Newsom declared a moratorium on carrying out the death penalty and is considering closing a state prison. Meanwhile, voters in San Francisco and other counties have elected progressive district attorneys who are looking to shine a light on how law enforcement and prosecutors are contributing to an unfair justice system. Some advocates for criminal justice reform say that these reforms don't go far enough. One of our guests tonight argues that his colleagues in the legal profession have their own share of the blame about what ails the U.S. criminal justice system. Alex Karakatsanis, lawyer, author, and civil rights activist, writes about it all in his new book, Usual Cruelty, The Complicity of Lawyers in the Criminal Justice System. And for an opposing perspective from the prosecutorial side of this debate, I'm also happy to welcome Steve Wagstaff, District Attorney of San Mateo County. Gentlemen, welcome to you both.
Good evening.
Great to be here.
And of course, we welcome you, our listeners, to join our conversation. We'll open our phone lines in about 20 minutes. The number to dial is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email us anytime at cityvisions@klw.org. So, Alex Karakatsanis, I wanted to start with you as a setup for the reason you wrote this book and the work that you do. Why don't you read to us an excerpt from the introduction?
I'd be happy to. Thank you. There are 2.2 million human beings confined in prison and jail cells in the United States tonight. About 500,000 of those people are presumptively innocent people awaiting trial, the vast majority of whom are confined by the government solely because they cannot pay enough money to buy their release. This country has 5% of the world's population, but 25% of the world's prisoners, the highest rate of human caging of any society in the recorded history of the modern world. At least another 4.5 million human beings are under government control through probation and parole supervision. Between 80 and 90% of the people charged with crimes are so poor that they cannot afford a lawyer. 25 years into America's incarceration boom, black people were incarcerated at rates 6 times that of South Africa during the height of apartheid. The incarceration rate for black people in the nation's capital, where I live, is 19 times that of white people. I have traveled the country and seen nearly identical practices in every courtroom and every jail that I've visited. We have a legal system in which things like what happened to Charnell Mitchell are simultaneously illegal and the norm. That reference right there to Charnell Mitchell was a reference to a story that I opened the book with about a client of mine who was ripped from her one-year-old child who was on her lap and her four-year-old who was next to her by local police because she owed some money on unpaid traffic tickets. And she was sent to a jail cell and told that she had to sit in the jail cell and work off her debt as a janitor for the city of Montgomery. And I opened the story with her book, which was really the first time I had started bringing civil rights cases to challenge mass incarceration. I had started my career as a public defender. And it was in that moment where we started suing jurisdictions all over the country that we became interested in the money bail system and the wealth-based attention that characterizes pretrial legal system all over the country. And I think you asked me to read this excerpt because I think it really highlights the extent to which all of us have become so desensitized to the brutality of human caging that all over the country, hundreds of thousands times every day, we're caging people just because they can't make a monetary payment.
So your points in that excerpt there that the numbers are too high, they're disproportionate, and the burden of being incarcerated falls disproportionately on people who are poor and people of color, and that there's a lot of people who you feel are behind bars, and you call it caged, who shouldn't be there.
That's one of the points that I make, is that no human being should be in a cage. And one of the things that our society has done is it's taken social problems and social issues and used a brutal, cruel tool like human caging. It didn't have to be that way. In fact, many societies throughout the history of the world don't do that, haven't done that. And something very particular happened in this country 40 or 50 years ago. We started trying to deal with social problems like poverty and drug addiction and violence and alienation through the human caging system. And I think that was a really fatal decision. And it's had enormous impact for tens of millions of people, particularly poor people and people of color. And when you actually look at what's going on, it's not some random distribution of the population that's being targeted. It's people who are impoverished and people of color. They're being targeted, as I mentioned, at 19 times the rates of white people in the city that I live. And if you look at every city and every town across the country, in every county, every state, the same disproportionate impacts are happening. And you have to wonder, is the system unintentionally, just sort of haphazardly and without any evidence doing this sort of randomly, or is it part of an intentional process? Is it serving some other kind of function to control and surveil and cage certain categories of people? And so one of the things I argue in the book is if you look at what we decide to make a crime, how we punish that, who we enforce it against, a pattern starts to emerge. And you start to think of the system as not, it's not that the people who are running the system are stupid. You know, they tell us that the purpose of the system is public safety and justice and equality and creating a society where all human beings can flourish. Well, if that's its goal, it's actually remarkably poor at achieving it. 40 years into what's called the war on drugs, drug usage rates are higher than they were before. So it's not that these people who are running the system are stupid. They just don't get it. In fact, I think what's going on is the purpose of the system is something else. The purpose of the system, as I mentioned, is to further these systems of capitalism and white supremacy. And if you think of that as its goal, this bureaucracy, which takes 12 million people every single day from their schools and homes and families and churches and jobs and communities and puts them into government-run cages of concrete and metal, that system is actually remarkably effective. It's an incredibly effective bureaucracy if you change what you think of as its goals. And so one of the things I argue in the book, and maybe the main thesis of the first essay in the book, is that I don't actually think that all of us who work in the bureaucracy, lawyers, judges, prosecutors, public defenders, probation officers, parole officers, police officers, it's not that we're all so dumb and we've been trying to accomplish this lofty, wonderful, equal justice type of goal, and we've just been horribly ineffective at it, spending trillions of dollars a year, trillions of dollars over the last 40 years. It's actually that our goals have been something different, and measured by those what our actual goals are, we've actually been very effective. And the reason that matters is your theory for why the system looks the way that it does should affect what kinds of interventions you think we should make to fix it. If you think the system is just unintentionally broken, you're going to have one sort of set of explanations and theories and policy proposals. If you think the system is actually intentionally pursuing these goals, you're going to have a different theory for how to attack it. And so that's sort of one of the foundational pieces that I begin the book with.
So basically, what you're saying is that you have a system that is created to have the outcomes that you see, and that we have to kind of bring that to light if we're really going to get to the root of the problem in order to figure out what needs to change.
That's exactly right. So just take, for example, the many people think that the system is the money bail system. Let's just take that as for one example. It's horribly ineffective. All of the evidence from around the country shows that not only are hundreds of thousands of poor people detained because they can't pay, and in fact, right now, as we're sitting here talking, 400,000 people are in jail right now, prior to trial, before conviction, because they can't make a payment. All of the evidence shows that money bail doesn't do anyone any good. It doesn't get people back to court. It doesn't promote public safety. In fact, it increases crime by taking people away from their jobs and families and destabilizing their lives so that people who are detained on money bail prior to their trial are actually more likely to commit crime in the future. So if you thought that the system was just stupid, then you might bring some of that data and empirical evidence and show the people who are running the system, hey, you know what? This thing that you've been doing, not only is it enriching the for-profit money bail industry to the tune of billions of dollars a year from the poorest people in our society, it's actually ineffective, and it's costing local jurisdictions and counties, like all the counties in the Bay Area, hundreds of millions of taxpayer dollars each year. You should just change what you're doing. Well, we've all tried that for decades. We've been telling people that this doesn't work. It doesn't even work on its own terms, and nothing has changed. In fact, it's gotten worse. So why is that? I think it's because the system actually doesn't care about those outcomes. It's pursuing a different type of outcome. And when you have that as your theory, the types of interventions that you make change. You're no longer going to people and saying, here's what the evidence shows, let's do something different. You understand that what's actually going on is a contest at the level of real power, and the criminal punishment bureaucracy is a tool that the ruling class uses to keep people in their place, to control, to cage certain groups of people in our population, poor people, people of color. And if that's your theory, then the types of interventions you're going to make include things like organizing, building power in communities, listening to the voices of directly impacted people and helping them build power to challenge these systems at the level of real power. Because if you don't build that power, even if we strike down something like the money bail system, and I'd love to talk about what California did to the money bail system because I think it's the perfect example of this, you can get rid of the money bail system, but the same people that created the money bail system are still going to be in power, and those people are going to decide what replaces the money bail system. And that is the key lesson. If you don't build power to change who's deciding these things, the same people are going to build the same systems, and you'll have maybe the same mechanism of oppression oppressing the same people with a different label. And that's, unfortunately, what we're about to see happen in California with the money bail system.
So, Alex Karakatsanis, opening up our conversation this evening, he's the author of a new book that is asking the questions that perhaps no one else is asking about what is wrong with our criminal justice system, looking at it in a different way. He's the author of the book Usual Cruelty, The Complicity of Lawyers in the Criminal Justice System. And I want to get back to you, the role of lawyers specifically in just a moment. But next, I wanted to turn to Steve Wagstaff, who is, district attorney for the San Mateo County, to offer his response and perspective on the on opening statements here, so to speak, by Alec, specifically that the criminal justice system in the United States is really aimed at more at social control, at perpetuating capitalism, white supremacy, as he puts it, and at really trying to solve social problems through a criminal lens. What do you make of that?
I've heard the perspective many times over the decades that are done. One needs to look historically. I look at it historically, not sociologically. I look back as to the system that existed was developed in California, which is where my experience is. Alec is far more, he's got a far bigger breadth of attention looking at 49 other states. I speak to California. And I look became a prosecutor in the 1970s when it was a very strong effort to be enlightened, to not just lock people up. It was efforts were made to put as many people as we could on probation with services. I understand that Alec would feel that that's still a cage of sort, although not a jail cell, it's still a cage. But we tried to do that. California's population in their jail in 1979, 1980 was 18,000 in the state that was not that much smaller at that time. We grew to 180,000. In our prison system by the year after 2000, 2010, up to 180,000 because of what occurred in the 80s. Historically, what occurred was that crime went out of control. And I'm not just talking about drug crimes and the war on drugs and that, which I didn't know was still going on, but I thought it had basically come to an end in California overall. But the but what happened historically was that people reacted to that. That's when the laws got tough. That's when people started locking up. And remember, there's a category he never mentioned of persons. And I don't know why it's left out. And I hear this constantly left out, and that's judges. Judges hold the most power here. DAs, of course, are extremely powerful. I don't minimize that. But judges are the ones who decide, is somebody going to prison? They stay in local. One can have that. But I think one has to include the whole group. So that's why it exploded. And obviously in 2009, 2010, actually 2011, formally in California, we went into what we are now about to enter our ninth year of criminal justice reform. And we've taken that prison population and reduced it by 50,000. The population in the California prison system is running, it'll vary between 125 up to 130. It has been below the cap put on it by the federal judges, whatever. I don't care what the motivation is. It's been done. And we in the system, and I am certainly part of that system, have worked hard to try and give alternatives to people. We've done it. We've had money from the state of California. Governor Brown, very enlightened governor, sent money down to counties. We, in little San Mateo County, we were getting $15 to $18 million a year to try and provide programs. programs for people. And it's made a dramatic difference in terms of what we are doing. Criminal justice reform has been, as you noted in your opening remarks, has changed so many of their laws, whether it's felony murder, whether it's the bail law, whether it is the taking all the drug possession offenses and making them misdemeanors, not felonies anymore. You can't go to prison. We're not even incarcerating anybody for simple possession of crimes. We're putting them in programs of various sorts. So one can do a view of what's going on here. It's, I think what Alec describes sounds a lot more organized than anything I've seen in my travels around the state of California, to imply that there is somebody behind it. The people, as DAs, were an enforcement arm. As I keep telling my prosecutors, the 60 prosecutors in my office, we never gripe what comes out of Sacramento or comes out of the electorate and initiative, because it's democracy. And the legislative branch develops the laws. The judicial branch is the one that does the sentencing on those laws. And the executive branch, which is the prosecutor, decides what goes on. When it comes down to the idea of poverty, I actually share a lot of Alec's views on that. I do believe that impoverished people, as much as society may try to put public defenders such as he was, try to put qualified public defenders to help, admittedly, there are people who get more. And our world doesn't change that much. Take a look at the big crisis of all these very wealthy people convicted of racketeering offenses for what they tried to get their kids into colleges by cheating and lying on that line. And they're getting nothing. They're getting no punishment. And I have to concur, that's offensive to me when that happens, when I see it. In our county, when we have somebody who's of wealth, we try to treat them and prosecute them the same as anybody else, whether they have $5 in their pocket or $5 million in their pocket. And in San Mateo County, there's a lot of those $5 million pockets, and we try to make sure there's no benefit done by that in any fashion. And I think our judges try to do that, too. But one could probably find lots of examples of circumstances.
And how about the concern that there's a disproportionate number of people of color in incarcerated? What do you make of that?
I actually have for decades, including with a judge from my county, the first African-American judge in San Mateo County, who was appointed in the 1970s, and he and I talked about this with regularity. And his view that I share is that it's a societal comment on the poverty level, not color in my book. Now, obviously, I'm not naive. There is a greater percentage of our population of people of color. In my county, it's not the African Americans. Too often in America, it's every point at African American. In my county, it's Latino Americans. And there's plenty of impoverishment going on there. But that it's so often it's the poverty is what drives it to me. We will not keep track. I have made a decision in my office. I will not track the race of individuals. I've been asked multiple times in interviews I've given, well, what about John Jones here? What did you feel on him about, you know, being a person of color? And I said, I had no idea what his color was. Now, one can say, obviously, the names sometimes convey, you know, a Jimenez often will do it, but I'm not so presumptuous as to do it. And I refuse to keep stats on that line because I want my prosecutors to be as colorblind as they can. But in my role as the DA, and when I was president of the California DA's Association 2 years ago, and talking with prosecutors around the state, the whole goal was to try and be fair. And I don't know when Alec refers to that, the people in power. Perhaps he's referring to the governor and the legislature, because they're the ones who set the rules for us and for judges who make the decisions. But again, I'm not for 1 second trying to not disagree with the theory that prosecutors are perhaps the most powerful. I don't think it's most powerful, but of equal power in terms of what happens in their courtrooms. And that's why we're trying to make changes. That's why DAs, the majority of DAs in California, aren't fighting this what we call criminal justice reform. We're trying to turn it into the best possible and make it work.
Okay, so back to you, Alec. Some of the points that Steve Wagstaff made was that poverty and race kind of travel together, and so it's really a poverty issue, not a separate race issue. Another issue here that he mentioned is that, in fact, it's true that the people who are poor seem to be disproportionately affected. So he does concede to that point to you. But then there's this question of how to approach fairness. He chooses not to look at the race of the people he's prosecuting or deciding to prosecute or those who work for him prosecute. What do you make of that approach, given what you've seen and what you're concerned about? And then the last thing, I'm giving you a lot of questions, but the last thing is this idea that, well, the prison population went up because the crime went up.
So there's a lot to respond to there. So just first, on your first question, in a society that was founded on stolen land and stolen labor and slavery and Jim Crow and the entire history of discrimination that led to every single aspect of the way that our society looks now, from who owns what to whose land is where to every single law that's on our books, what our neighborhoods look like, what our schools look like, how our relationships to other people are. Race has affected every single aspect of how our society is, including the distribution of wealth. Every single town and every single state that's ever been studied has had a racial discriminatory impact in the criminal legal system, in the terms of who the police are targeting, where they're patrolling, what crimes they're arresting people for, charging decisions by DA's offices, sentences by judges. Every single stage, every single study that's been done that I've ever seen has shown a racial disparity. Now, in the face of that entire history, everything that we know about white supremacy and how it infects every single one of our institutions, to say I'm just not going to look at someone's race seems to me a little naive. It also doesn't make it go away. The fact that you're blindfolding yourself to the racially discriminatory impacts of what is going on in your community, it's not just the DA's office. DA's office, I agree. I think that it's every single feature and aspect of our society and every single feature and aspect of our criminal punishment bureaucracy is having a racially disparate impact. To me, not studying it is actually, and not even collecting the data of what your prosecutors are doing, actually blinds you to the racially discriminatory impacts that you're having and lets you say things like, well, I'm not looking at it, so I'm trying to be colorblind. When in fact, everybody knows, and if there were independent researchers studying the charging decisions of your office, like for example, the Milwaukee DA's office opened up its charging decisions and because they wanted to know, like, we're not trying to be racist, let's say. That was their line. We're not intentionally being racist. We want to know, are we having disproportionate? And it turns out, like in every other office that's been studied, the decisions that are being made by DAs, just like decisions that are being made by police officers and judges, are having a racially disparate impact. So not studying it is actually just doesn't make the problem go away. I mean, that's my first reaction. I think this point about crime going up is a very interesting one to me, and I talk about it a little bit in the book. So let me just make a couple of background points about that. Number one, crime is actually not a very serious social problem. When you put it in context with other kinds of social problems, for example, we are much more likely to die in a traffic accident, texting while driving or you know, just even a regular traffic accident, going 6 miles over the speed limit, way more dangerous than any kind of other crime that we're threatened with in our society. By far, air pollution, water pollution, these are things that kill way more people. Cigarettes, for example, kill 450,000 Americans every single year. 45,000 Americans die from secondhand smoke alone. That's 15 September 11th every single year. There are a lot of easily preventable. Alcohol is another one, right? So drunk driving, when the study was done in 2004, drunk driving killed as many people as all what's called illegal drug use combined. Drunk driving is barely criminalized, right? One of the points I make in the book at great length is that the things that we make crimes, we don't, for example, make it a crime to be a distributor of tobacco, right? Even though we know that causes way more harm than all other drugs combined. The things that we choose to make a crime are based on who owns things in our society, who has power in our society. Then, taking a step forward, where we look for the people that commit that crime. So we have decided to criminalize in most states the offense of holding the marijuana plant in your hand. However, if you go to, you know, Yale University in New Haven, Connecticut, there aren't undercover police officers arresting students for smoking marijuana every single night. But if you go right down the street in New Haven, there's SWAT team raids and people of color being handcuffed and chained and taken away from their children every single day because they're holding the marijuana plant. So there's this disparate impact and all of that is to the point where what we think of as crime has been socially constructed. crime is not sort of some inviolate objective notion. And so when we say things like the crime rate went up in the 1980s, that is totally devoid of meaning. If what we care about is the number of human beings who are killed or maimed or taken away from their family or the risk of dying, we would have focused on things like clean air and clean water and homelessness. Everybody who studies all of this research understands that homelessness is way more connected with all of these things than criminal activity, with deaths, with early sickness, with drug use, right? So I guess the point is that my point is that the ruling class understood that if it targeted certain types of activity and called those things criminal, it could use that to justify massive repression of people that enabled them to control whole swaths of the population. They could no longer say things like, you are not permitted to vote because of the color of your skin. You're no longer permitted to vote because you can't give us $100 as a poll tax. What they do instead, they call certain activity crime, regardless of how harmful that activity is, knowing that other things were way more harmful than that activity. And then they said, you're no longer allowed to vote if you have a conviction for a crime, right? You see what I'm saying? So they perpetuated the same mechanisms of oppression. You're no longer allowed to have this job if you have a criminal record, right? They recreated a lot of the same hierarchies of oppression in our society using different labels. They used the criminal system to accomplish what before they didn't need the criminal system for. And so if you take a look at the types of activities that actually cause harm to people, that make people sick, that lead them to die, that cause violent crime. Like, for example, we know now that one of the leading contributors to sort of violent behavior is exposure to lead as a child, right? Instead of addressing that underlying problem in neighborhoods where other forms of capitalist exploitation led to lead pollution, we just started caging the people that grew up in those neighborhoods. And I think that's the response of a ruling class that doesn't want to actually change the fundamental features of our society and redistribute wealth and power and property, but wants to control the people who it's already exploited for centuries.
So, Steve Wagstaff, I want to ask you two questions in your response. The first is, would you open your office to independent review by an academic organization that wanted to look at whether there was bias within who your prosecutors choose to prosecute?
We did it, yes.
And what was your result?
We did it last year from a professor at UCLA who came up and asked to be able to do it, look at implicit bias in our office. And I said, certainly, be happy to do that. If it's there, in any way you can find it, do so. And he found that, yes, there was some, obviously some. It was educational for us. So then what we did, we followed up after he did his survey. It was a blind survey he did of my prosecutors. What he, after that, is we then had him come up and do an all-staff, all-prosecutor staff meeting where he spent a day telling us about implicit bias, where it is, where trying to basically raise consciousness. I viewed that as a good first step. It wasn't the end all. It wasn't a check the box. But yes, I am very open to that type of thing, because if we can do it better, I have no concern about somebody telling me we're doing it wrong.
So if you're welcoming this, why aren't you continuing to keep the statistics?
Well, the statistics are there. We have a case management system that has it all there. We just simply, I don't publish them. If anybody wants them, it's their public record. They can get the statistics and who we're prosecuting and why. Mine is, I don't want my prosecutors sitting there getting reports on that. I want them to, my belief is, I want them to simply do the job. I want their consciousness to be raised. I want my own. I'm the oldest guy in the office by a long shot. I want my own eyes to be widened. So I'm open to that. And people want to come in and study our office. That's fine. I'm happy to do it. We're a public office. We serve the people. But I don't want it to be on their mind day in and day out looking, oh, this person is this or that. I think that would lead to inherent bias in my book.
I'm going to have Alec respond to that in just a moment. But I wanted to now get to the other point that he made, which is rebutting your point that the reason the population in prisons and jails increased so much starting in the 80s was because crime went up. And he's taking issue with how crime is defined and that it, in fact, it's a method of social control, how that is disproportionate to those affected, disproportionately those who are poor and people of color. I know you don't get to decide what are called crimes. You just have to apply the law in deciding whether or not to prosecute. But what do you make of that idea, that in fact the types of crimes that you are being asked to prosecute perhaps are flawed at their core?
I think there have been many over the decades I've been watching. There have been laws that have been flawed, and I've done what I can to work with the legislature to try and change that. But again, I'm not sure exactly who Alec is calling this sort of ephemeral, the ruling class, the enterprise. There may be somebody he defines for me. I'm working in California within the criminal justice system, and change can happen. And that's from within criminal justice, coming out of Sacramento with our governor and our legislature. But we've done it in California. We've started the road. We started for 9 years now. We've been traveling the road to try and change away from what he said, reduced our population in prison by a third, trying to do more. Governor, you noted, Governor Newsom may be closing another prison. He may be taking how we deal with juveniles in a whole different path. Those are all ideas that we look at and we're open to. I don't think you change what Alec has described as something that's gone on for centuries. I don't think you change it overnight. You change it over time, and I think California is starting to do that, and they're doing it with support from all avenues and all quarters.
I want to reintroduce the program. This is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're talking with Steve Wagstaff, District Attorney of San Mateo County, and Alex Karakatsanis, lawyer and author of Usual Cruelty, The Complicity of Lawyers in the Criminal Justice System. We invite you, our listeners, to call in with your questions and comments. Do you feel that our current system of punishment works? Have you felt that there is too much reform or not enough when it comes to criminal justice reform? Join our conversation by dialing 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can email us at cityvisions@kalw.org, post a comment at the KLW website, or on our Facebook page. And we're also on Twitter at cityvisionskalw. So, Alec, I wanted you to respond there specifically to the question that Steve asks. When you say the ruling class, who exactly are you talking about here? And other comments you'd like to make about his response.
Yeah, so that point is really, I think there's a tendency sometimes when I make that point, or when other people make that point, it's not an original point to me, to want to isolate some particular person or group of people, like judges or the governor or rich people, right, as like some kind of agent. I don't think that these social systems function in exactly the same way as like an intentional actor might. It's not the same thing as like identifying someone who has committed an action and then punishing them for that action. And like social systems move with a certain level of intent, and we sometimes use intentional sounding words to describe what they're doing. What I'm really talking about is the set of relationships and processes that determine what actually happens in our society. So these are the types of systems that determine who owns things, where the development will go. Once the development is there, what kind of policies is the city going to enact around it? Is it going to exclude certain people from it, right? And at the core, what the criminal law is really doing is it is the vehicle by which, having taken land, let's say my family took land from your family 150 years ago, the criminal system is the way that now, you know, we've created something called ownership over that land. And now what that really means is if you come on to this land that I took from you, I can call the police and use the force and violence of the state to exclude you from that land. What I'm talking about when I say the ruling class, I'm really talking about the people that control those processes and own that property throughout our society. It's the same way that our neighborhoods got so segregated and that the distribution of wealth has become so unequal. There are certain forces in our society who tend to get what they want, whether it's healthcare policy, foreign policy, domestic policy in terms of school policy, the rules that regulate business transactions. So all of the laws are written not with like some one emperor sitting behind, you know, a wall sort of like determining in every last instance everything that happens, but powerful moneyed interests sort of control everything that happens in our society. When I'm talking about the ruling class, I'm talking largely about the property owning sort of mostly white, like class whose decisions and preferences tend to determine what happens in our world.
So what I'm hearing from you is, if you take this at the 50,000 foot level, so to speak, you could see the connections between decades, centuries of what you call white supremacy and capitalism driving how the criminal justice system sort of comes together to reinforce those systems. When it comes to the on-the-ground level, what are you hoping people like Steve Wagstaff or police officers or judges do to get at some of these injustices when it's sort of the intricate web that you're painting is quite tight and quite seems and quite impenetrable. But what can one person or groups of people do on their day-to-day level interacting as members with and operators within this system?
Yeah, so I think one of the things the DA said is very important, which is that poverty is a real driver of what's going on in the criminal legal system. Once you acknowledge that, you have to ask yourself a really important question. Should we be punishing people? Let's say you even believe that poor people commit crime at a greater rate. And keep in mind, we've socially constructed what is called a crime, and that even among the things we call crimes, we're largely disproportionately policing those crimes in poor communities and not in wealthy communities. But let's just say that you think poor people commit certain types of crime at higher rates. One fascinating thing to me is, why was our response to that as a society to cage those people that committed those crimes? Even if you think those crimes are causing serious harm, there is not a shred of scientific evidence since mass incarceration was conceived 40 years ago, not a shred of evidence that caging someone who commits a certain act will lead to a world where that act happens less. And that's such a fascinating thing for me, because let's say, for example, that you're very concerned with sexual assault and domestic violence, which I think all of us want a society where there is none of that happening, right? There is not a shred of evidence that caging someone who commits one of those acts is the way to a world where less of that is happening. In fact, if you look at the sort of the carceral approach we've taken to domestic violence, it hasn't curbed gender-based violence at all over the last 40 years. Instead, there are things like toxic masculinity and various forms of gender inequality in our society and poverty that are actually actually creating a lot of that gender-based violence. And so one thing that fascinates me is, why did the ruling class decide that its response to these crimes, supposedly, we heard from the DA, caused by poverty, why was their response caging poor people who commit those crimes rather than eradicating poverty? And I think the answer to that question is that most people in the ruling class, they want a society that looks as close to our society as possible. They love the way our society looks. It's worked very well for them. If the answer to crime means dramatically changing our society so that it's more equal, so that our neighborhoods are less segregated, so that the distribution of wealth is less extreme, so that people own land, have a safe place to live and work, where men weren't dominating every aspect of our society and white men weren't dominating every aspect of our society, they wouldn't like the way that other society looked. We could have a society with almost no crime, with far less crime. We could abolish most of these systems like police and prosecution and public defense and jails. We don't need them if we had a society that was drastically more equal. But the ruling class decided, instead of pursuing things that would take us to that path, they pursued crime, control, and jailing. And the key fact that you need to understand is none of them, not then, not 10 years ago, not 5 years ago, not today, had a single shred of evidence that it led to less crime.
So, Steve Wagstaff, what of this assertion that Alec makes that, in fact, punishment doesn't work and you've got it all wrong and you've got to go to the root cause and fix that and, handling things at the other side once the crime has been committed is just wrongheaded?
Well, I respect his view on it, and I think it's true for people who are entering into the criminal justice system. I think it would be stupid to simply say, lock them up. I don't know anybody, again, in my experience, except for the most egregious of crimes, the murder, the rape, that type of thing, that we're saying automatically today that you go to prison. It was true in the 80s. It was true in the 90s. There were first timers, absolutely, went to prison. But not that. When somebody has a drug problem, including drug dealers, whatever, of course we were trying to get them into treatment. But when they keep victimizing, and that's the word that hasn't been uttered tonight, and that's the first time it's been said, is victims, and the concern for victims, and that's where I come from, not at the 50,000-foot level, but at the 100-foot level when I'm dealing with victims day in and day out, is the concept of what can we do to try and prevent those people from engaging further. And that's what we're trying to do in California now. We're doing so much more treatment programs, so much more there. But I know it's just, I'm sure Alec would disagree with it. All I can tell you is a historical fact. Again, because as a historian, I look and I say, you look at the crime that occurred, And yes, we over-incarcerated. Let me come right out and say we locked up way too many people. Fear played a big part in it. A million other, probably some of what Alex referring to played a big part in it. But the bottom line is crime has dropped to levels that we have not seen since the 1930s. Now, I know I've talked to a million people who say, you know, the criminal justice system played no role in that. It's societal factors. And I say, you can have that view. I don't agree with it. I think obviously what occurred in criminal justice played a role. But we did over-incarcerate. So now we're trying to, for almost going on a decade in California, we're trying to backtrack and find that middle road, the best road.
So you're saying that punishment is inevitable at some point because there are repeat offenders and you just can't not punish them.
I do believe that. That is a core belief that I have in criminal justice and its role in society.
This is City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. And tonight we're talking with Steve Wagstaff, District Attorney of San Mateo County, and Alex Karakassanis, lawyer and author of Usual Cruelty, The Complicity of Lawyers in the Criminal Justice System. 866-798-TALK is the number to dial to join our conversation. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email us at cityvisions@KALW.org, or you can tweet us at City Visions KLW or post a comment at the KLW website. Let's go to Ariana in San Francisco. Ariana, welcome to the program.
Yes, I have a few comments if you can bear with me. I'm a clinical psychologist and I wrote my academic research on prisoner reentry and the criminalization of people of color. Just a few points that the society that we live in, the societies that are the most unhappiest are the ones with the greatest gross economic disparity. And with poverty comes powerlessness, and there's the desire to reestablish equilibrium and power. And so sometimes that's done through violence, and that has to be contained. And also it's done through addiction, where people are trying to self-soothe because they are experiencing extraordinarily uncomfortable and fragmenting emotions. I think that there's a few ways, though, that we need to think about this both globally and, you know, as a nation and individually as a form of reparations. The first thing is to think about how this country was formed, and that is when the white Europeans came here. I'm not talking about the Native Americans. When they came here and the Puritans came here, they believed in that those who had privilege and power, those who were known by their goods, their wealth, were preferred by God. They were God's elect. So in this country, we favored people who have privilege. And at the same time, with Puritanism, we think that those who indulge in their desires are to be condemned. So this is a contradictory philosophy. And so we judge very, very harshly people who have drug addictions of any kind. We see them as out of control. Even obesity in this culture. And so there's a punishing aspect to that. It's not just about racism.
I understand from my producer that you also wanted to talk about reentry and recidivism. Do you have something to say about that? Because we do need to move on.
Yeah. And crime is in every strata, every class, and all aspects of the society. But when we look at helping people come back, 95% of all incarcerated folks are going to be returning to society. We need to understand that what needs to be restored is respect and belonging. Those people who've been welcomed, where there's even been rituals that help them feel part of and worthy of being part of society, where there's a job set up for them, where there's housing, and where there's a sense that they belong and that they contribute and to find ways to contribute. This has a healing aspect to them, not in every case, because obviously if someone's a danger, you know, violent, that's an issue. But in most cases, most of the people locked up are not violent to others. And their acts of desperation come from, in part, desperation, but also sometimes problems that can be remediated and problems that we as society have to grow out of, which includes sharing and becoming more of a love-based society instead of a punishing society, which just doesn't work.
Thanks so much for your call. So Alec, I want you to respond there, and I'll give you a chance to respond to Steve, to Ariana's comments specifically about reentry and recidivism. But I also want you to respond to Steve's comment, which is that at some point there are people who we just have to incarcerate because they keep repeating the offense. And you're talking about upstream changes, but there's the downstream consequences on victims that also need to be taken into consideration.
I think one of the things that Arianna said is very important to understand, and I think it's a direct rebuttal to what Steve was saying. 96% of all arrests in this country are for what the FBI calls nonviolent crimes. The vast bulk of this criminal punishment bureaucracy that's employing millions of people and enriching to the tune of billions, many, many corporations in our society, the vast bulk of what that entire bureaucracy is doing has nothing to do with what's called violent crime. This myth that they are selling us, that the system is to protect us from violent predators, is an egregious distraction from what the system is actually doing. There's a fantastic book by a California professor named Alexandra Nadipoff called Punishment Without Crime, which examines the way in which much of the bulk of the criminal punishment bureaucracy is churning low-level crimes through the system for the enrichment and profit and control of a small group of people in our society. So that's one thing. So before we even get to this notion of a violent predator, we have to understand that's not what the vast bulk of the system is doing. Instead, we're devoting billions of dollars to this kind of revolving punishment door, this assembly line, which we could be devoting to the kinds of things Arianna was talking about, creating a community that holds someone, that meets their human needs, their physical and mental and psychological and emotional needs, that creates relationships between people and communities, that eradicates the kind of alienation and desperation that she was talking about, that actually are the things that lead people to things like drug addiction and to conduct that might hurt other people. And if as a society we cared about creating those human bonds and providing people with the material things that they need, like a safe and clean place to live, like access to theater and art and music and poetry and literature and sports and all of the things that some of us take for granted as the things that give life meaning, if we had a society that valued that in all human beings instead of a horribly brutal and unequal society in which many, many people can't even access those things for their children even if they wanted to, then I think we'd see a lot less of what people call crime. And I think
I want to get you back to the victim question, though. What do you say to victims of violent crimes when you're discussing the fact that the crime itself was, you know, related to a series of upstream conditions that I don't think actually Steve argues against? How do you factor that in?
Again, the research again speaks for itself. The vast majority of people who've been victimized by a crime don't like the current criminal punishment bureaucracy. They're not getting anything from it. What they want, the vast majority of them, is to not be victimized again and for other people not to be victimized again. That's not what our criminal punishment bureaucracy is doing. Our criminal punishment bureaucracy is causing more crime. We know that. And if you look at, Steve, I'm glad to hear Steve say that they're not jailing sort of first-time offenders. If you look at San Mateo's bail schedule, which is available on the website, if you're arrested for a crime in San Mateo, virtually any crime, no matter what it is, first-time offender, you're held in jail if you're poor. If you can't afford that bail money, you're kept in a cage, away from your family, away from your job. That leads to more crime. And that's happening every single day right now in San Mateo, in San Francisco, in Santa Clara, in Alameda. There are thousands of people in a jail cell just because they can't pay who haven't even been convicted yet. So this is a system that doesn't take seriously the good points that I think Steve was just making. And now at the end of the day, there are some people who, for a variety, whatever your theory is for why, how they ended up this way, who right now are a danger to other people, right? And that's a difficult question that we have to confront. People like me who don't want any form of human caging have to confront that there's some small number of people who right now, because of the way that our society looks, are in a position to hurt other people. And that is why I think a lot of abolitionists sort of talk about this journey to abolition, a journey to a world that doesn't create people like that. It doesn't create people who for whatever reason, I actually, you know, on the more radical side of the spectrum, where I wouldn't even lock up those people. I would devote extraordinary resources to working with them to making sure that they and other people around them are safe in other ways that we know is backed up by the evidence and the research. But before we even get to that debate, before we even have that discussion about what to do for that person, we have to acknowledge that 95% of the criminal punishment bureaucracy has nothing to do with that person. So we should demolish that and devote all of those resources to those small number of cases. And I think from the conversations that I've had with people that have been victimized, keep in mind, the line between someone who's a victim one day and a so-called perpetrator of a crime another day is very thin. Many of the people that are victimized by crime are living in the same communities as the people that are being incarcerated. And so we have this cycle of this vicious cycle in our society of punishment and victimization that sort of perpetuates itself. And for many, many years, the district attorneys in California, just to take one example, they refused to give crime victims money from the crime victims funds if that person had a criminal record. Imagine that, right? And then there's no better story that exposes what the criminal punishment bureaucracy is really about than that. We have created this myth in our minds of who a victim is and what that victim looks like that is devoid of the sort of racial and class implications that are actually characterizing most of these communities. So for me, I think I find this narrative around victims and what victims want. When you talk to actual victims, they don't want the criminal punishment bureaucracy as it looks today.
Steve, your response to that?
The Victim Services Division in San Mateo County has been part of my office since 2001. I don't know what Alec is referring to when it comes to DAs having any control over what California's law is, that if you refuse to participate with the prosecution of somebody, you do not get victim benefits. I've never heard, though, in California of a rule that said that certainly DAs have control over saying, no, if you have a criminal record, you cannot. I know the contrary. I know for at least 20 years and back, we have given plenty of money to that person that Alec is describing who has a criminal record but who is a victim on that line. As to his other points are actually the point Adriana was making that I didn't want to let slip away, and that is addiction. Addiction is something that has, I don't know if it's anything like it in the world. I'm not as well traveled to know, but I just know so many addicts and know what they're going through and what we're trying to do. And I agree, when we were locking them up, and we did, that accomplished nothing for society in my book. And now that's not happening. Now what we're doing is we're trying to get them, but so many of them are not taking the treatment. They talk about opioids around the country. It's not San Mateo County. For us, it's methamphetamine. And it has a grip on the people in our community that is devastating. Our homelessness is directly tied to that methamphetamine. And I do very much agree with Alec on that. Boy, if we, and Adriana, if we can do some steps there, And the other side is on the bail. I do want to mention that. We haven't had a lot of time to talk about that. But two things. Number one, San Mateo County, it was supposed to start today. It will start in January. We are starting a new means of bail because right now, Alec is right, our bail schedule is there for anybody arrested on a felony. They're going to probably have bail set on that, and that's changing in January to where categories. If you're the low-level offender, mid-level, you're going to be getting OR'd. And so to me, we're trying to make these changes. California's trying to make that change on bail on the ballot next November to try and do it the right way and at least take some steps in what I think of as the right direction.
Let's go to Matt in Oakland. Matt, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I had a question. I grew up in San Bruno in San Mateo County, and I had a question just about kind of the ways in which the DA's office, various police departments are working together to kind of connect the dots on this, working with, schools, working with economic development centers to kind of talk about breaking this cycle of poverty. And I also was hoping to get a comment on I believe a statistic I heard recently that said that there's something like a 20-year difference in life expectancy between folks who live in East Palo Alto, which I believe is mid-60s, to folks who live in Atherton, where they live to, I think, their mid-80s. And what is San Mateo County doing to address the clear race and class disparities between communities like that and help improve quality of life for everyone in the county?
Thanks, Matt, for your call. So to the point that you have control over in terms of the life expectancy, what do you see San Mateo County and your office being able to do?
what we do, it's really the county, and we support it. But the county is trying to really change that city of East Palo Alto. They do wonderful things down there. I would urge him, if he grew up in San Bruno, take a walk through East Palo Alto today. It is a completely different town than it was 20 years ago. Other than that, that's a question that Alec and I would need a whole nother show to talk about.
Okay. And I want to turn, just as we wrap up our program, to the fact that San Francisco elected a former public defender, or I guess he's still a public defender until he takes office, Chesa Boudin, who ran on a progressive platform to really try to shine the light on how prosecutors and the law enforcement are contributing to an unjust or unfair criminal justice system. So I know, Alec, that you and Chesa are friends. I'm curious, what advice do you have for Chesa as he takes office? And I'm going to ask you the same, Steve, as we wrap up our program tonight.
I think the thing I'll say is he can't take on too much. As a prosecutor, your role is really limited. I think he can do a lot less harm than his predecessors. He can be a lot less cruel. He can participate a lot less in this banality of brutality that is sort of characterizes every single day, but in the criminal legal system here in San Francisco. But you can't think of these problems as in a silo. It's not like he can snap his fingers or with a stroke of his pen change the incredible inequality that characterizes daily life in San Francisco. And, you know, we talk about violent crime, but our conception of violence is also really socially constructed. To me, it's a form of violence that life expectancy is 20 years lower in one community than another community. Think about what that means. It means that families are being evicted from their homes, and that's what's leading to lower life. People are unable to access basic health care. People are unable to access the things that make us the wealthiest and most powerful country in the world. There's structural violence at the heart of that. Chesa, as a prosecutor, can't tackle any of those things. I think he's got to use his pulpit to get people to understand that the criminal legal system is just one place where our society is manifesting all these incredible inequalities that exist all around us. I think if he can do that, if he can show people that the criminal system is not the place where we should be spending billions of dollars a year to tackle problems that we're creating elsewhere, I think he'll be successful.
Steve?
My advice to Chesa, who I'm looking forward to meeting, is listen, listen, listen. He does have, as the district attorney, he is a person of significance in this community. People will listen to what he has to say. And he was very clear in the election, during the campaign, what he wanted to do. Now I say, in terms of becoming a prosecutor, listen to all segments from people, listen to prosecutors from all avenues of the – I mean, I know he's heard a great deal from the prosecutors in Philadelphia, Chicago, Boston. Now he wants to listen across the board and form his – and follow his own path as to what he can do to best serve that community.
So, Alec, you're in town promoting your book. Tell us how people can find out if they want to attend a reading and talk with you more about your book.
Yeah. So one thing I wanted to mention to be sure to mention before we go is that the book, which is called Usual Cruelty, The Complicity of Lawyers in the Criminal Injustice System. I think you said justice system earlier. I just wanted to make
sure. Sorry about that.
I don't use that term, a term of propaganda. I wanted to point out that all of the royalties from the book are being donated to an Oakland-based organization called SE Justice Group, which is an amazing organization that is organizing women with incarcerated loved ones in California. And I'll be doing an event on Thursday at lunchtime, and I'll give you the address in just a second.
We'll post it on our website.
Great.
So I want to thank Steve Wagstaff, District Attorney of San Mateo County, and Alec Carcassonis. Lawyer and author of Usual Cruelty, The Complicity of Lawyers in the Criminal Injustice System. Thank you for joining me this evening.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
For a look at other shows that we have coming up, or a look back to other shows we've done, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page at klw.org. Our engineer this evening was David LaTulipe. Tonight's show was produced by Wendy Holcomb. Join us again next Monday as my co-host Ethan Elkind talks about apps for therapy. This is Joseph Pache. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a great week.